After the absolute horror show that was the child-sacrificing reign of King Manasseh, Judah's monarchy has just about got the car back on the road. Josiah is a saint compared to some of his predecessors, and he purges both Judah and Israel of every last vestige of pagan worship. For those of you who've just jumped into the podcast, the general vibe in the Old Testament is that God expects Jews not only to believe in him, but to worship only him. However, the land where the Old Testament Jews live once belonged to a bunch of pagan nations and tribes known as the Canaanites, none of whom worshipped OG God, and who had gods like Baal, Ashtoreth, Asherah, Molech, and Dagon. Old Testament God is deeply unhappy when kings who should be worshipping him while setting an example to the rest of the country begin wholeheartedly embracing other deities. God's religious tolerance dial is set to zero, and things can only end badly. However, Josiah does turn things around spectacularly. His zeal for God makes him the Bible's model king, his virtue far outweighing even that most golden of monarchs, David. The question is it too little, too late? My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible Episode 92, The Broken and the Blind. Welcome, Bible fans. You join us at the Season 11 finale as we wrap up the second book of Kings and with it, the story of Israel's monarchy. If you're new, a few pointers to help you get the most from the next 20 minutes. If you're expecting a meditation or a Bible study, look away now. This is neither. Holy Bible treats the Bible as a book and doesn't assume that listeners are religious. Some people might find this sacrilegious, but my belief is that the Bible is for everyone, not just religious people. As for me, I'm an advertising creative director, not a theologian, nor a priest. Much of my job is taking complex information and simplifying it, which is pretty much all I'm doing here. Okay, King Josiah of Judah is at the wheel, and against all expectations, he's doing a pretty good job. The land of idol worship, Josiah returns to Jerusalem, where he sets about reintroducing the religious festivals that define the Jewish calendar. Thanks to Josiah, Judah celebrates its first Passover since the reign of Hezekiah, three generations earlier. The festival is devoutly God-focused and follows the rules laid down in the book of Exodus in a way they possibly have not been observed since the time of Moses. Josiah really does take the book of the law and run with it, ridding Judah of the mediums, pagan idols and household gods which have become the norm. Josiah even puts David in the shade when it comes to worshipping God with all his heart, soul and strength, and readers are told that there is no king like him either before or after his reign. Despite all this, God still appears to be furious because of Manasseh. Feel free to skip back an episode for all the gory details, but the crimes of this reprehensible king are seen by the Bible as irreversible. According to the second book of Kings, God announces that Judah will fall. Jerusalem is no longer special and will be rejected. Josiah has every right to feel satisfied at a job well done. But it's his commitment to his country that proves to be his undoing. The king hears that Egypt's pharaoh, Necho, is en route to join forces with the Assyrians under Nabopolassar. Nabopolassar isn't technically the king of Assyria, he's a Babylonian who has overrun Assyria to form the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Possibly unwilling to hang back and see what the combined firepower of Egypt and Assyria might decide to unleash on Judah, Josiah decides to head off Necho's army. As he tries to repel the Egyptian force, the king is killed in battle at Megiddo, otherwise referred to in the Bible as Armageddon. The loss of its king is a tragedy for Judah, and Josiah is taken back to Jerusalem for burial while one of his inept sons is left to steer his country away from an invasion that threatens to decimate it. The first of Josiah's children to take Judah's throne is seen by the Bible as a feckless waste of space who barely lasts 3 months in office. Jehoahaz is as godless as Josiah was godly. At the time he reigns, Egypt's pharaoh has ventured out of Africa and into the Near East, and it is here that he captures and kidnaps Judah's king, keeping him out of harm's way in the Assyrian city of Riblah, which can be found at the northeastern border of Lebanon and Syria on today's maps. Kingless and devoid of any power, Judah is now effectively a vassal state of Egypt, whose pharaoh orders its people to pay him a tax that weighs in at around 3.5 tons of gold and silver. If your brain doesn't work in imperial measurements, I'll put the metric ones in the notes. With Jehoahaz out of the way, Necho places another son of Josiah, Eliakim, on Judah's throne, and changes the man's name to Jehoiakim, simply because he can. Judah's king is really now just a puppet, and Jehoiakim's sole job, aside from getting used to his new name, appears to be raising the requisite amount of precious metal needed to pay Necho, which he does by extorting it out of his own people. Jehoiakim is seen by the writer of the second book of Kings as an evil man who does nothing to ensure the spiritual safety of his people, choosing instead to follow the pagan practices of many of his predecessors. It is during Jehoiakim's reign that Nebuchadnezzar II becomes king of Babylon. He invades Judah, and for the next 3 years, Jehoiakim has to divert his shipments of treasure from Egypt to Babylon instead. Thinking that Necho has his back, Jehoiakim defaults on these payments. However, no help comes from his allies to the south, and Babylon sends raiders from Judah's age-old enemies Aram, Moab, and Ammon to decimate the nation. Sadly for Jehoiakim, no respite comes from Egypt, and the writer points out that this betrayal was promised by numerous prophets, putting it down to God's lasting fury at Manasseh. According to sources outside the Bible, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon wins a decisive victory against the combined armies of Egypt and Assyria at the Battle of Carchemish in around 605 BC. After the battle, all Necho's gains outside of Egypt are lost, and the pharaoh never ventures north again. Assyria may have been the dominant Near Eastern power at the time that Israel was destroyed, but by the time it's Judah's turn to face the music, a new force is in control of the region. By 626 BC, it's the turn of the Neo-Babylonian Empire to be lord of all its surveys. Babylon itself is a city with a history stretching back into the mists of time. Some believe that Nimrod the Hunter established the place, and that this is the fabled city of Babel and its doomed tower. After the nation was ransacked by Sennacherib in 689 BC, it bounced back to defeat the Assyrians, and by the beginning of the 6th century BC, Babylon is the new force to be reckoned with in the Near East. By now, the city from which it gets its name is a successful metropolis at the heart of a vast empire that has defeated all comers. Its ruler, Nebuchadnezzar II, takes on Assyria and Egypt and is perfectly able to defeat both. By now, though, Judah is in free fall. The once proud nation is yet another vassal state of Babylon, and when Jehoiakim dies aged just 36, his 18-year-old son does nothing to avert what seems like the inevitable destruction of his nation. Given the pattern that godly kings thrive and godless ones bring disaster on their country, it doesn't help that the almost identically named Jehoiachin doesn't see following God as particularly important in his new role. During Jehoiachin's brief reign, Nebuchadnezzar lays siege to Jerusalem, arriving at the city in person. Rather than endure the horrors of a slow death that a siege usually entails, Jehoiachin and his advisers surrender. This means that, just 3 months into his reign, Judah's king is taken captive to Babylon, along with 10,000 of Jerusalem's officials, soldiers, skilled workers, and artisans. At the same time, Nebuchadnezzar carries away all the treasures from the royal palace and the temple, including any remaining gold placed there by Solomon. Only the poorest people in Israel are left to take care of their country, while Babylon's king chooses yet another of Josiah's sons to be king. This time, it is the turn of Mattaniah, whose name is changed to Zedekiah. Such is the lowly status of Judah that even its kings have no control over their own names. Zedekiah is described as Jehoiachin's uncle, yet he's just 21 years old when he assumes Judah's throne. This suggests that Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah may only be half-brothers, and that, saintly as he is portrayed in the Bible, Josiah had more than one queen. Judah's new king is no different to his brothers and nephew in his attitude to God, and the writer explains that God's anger against him is such that it expedites the ruin of his nation. Zedekiah rules his country more as a district governor than as a king, but at least he has a country to rule. Judah's treasures and the cream of its citizens may have departed east, but the infrastructure is intact. Its cities are still standing, and as long as money continues to trickle into Babylon's coffers, its people are relatively safe. Zedekiah has everything to lose. He just needs to keep a clear head and do what's best for his country and his people. Babylon's megalomaniac king has no time for the Jews' religion and no idea that he appears to be the fulfillment of centuries of prophecy. He is simply intent on a land grab that will expand his already bulging empire. 200 years before the Babylonian siege engines arrive at the gates of Jerusalem, the prophet Micah promised that Zion will be ploughed like a field. Many other prophets whose writings appear later on in the Bible, such as Obadiah, Joel, Zephaniah, Habakkuk, and Jeremiah, also warn that Judah's continued flirtation with idol worship will come at a cost. However, few of Judah's kings bother with destroying pagan shrines or maintaining even a veneer of worshipping God. Since the glory days of King Solomon, the land known to the Bible as Judah or the Southern Kingdom has only managed 4 godly kings out of a possible 20. Time appears to be up for God's chosen people. Their sojourn in the land promised to Abraham in perpetuity is over, and everything which they hold dear is about to be destroyed. All the second book of Kings tells its readers is that Zedekiah rebels against Babylon. The assumption is that the hapless king stops the flow of money into Babylon's coffers in the hope that his friends in Egypt will prove a more certain source of protection. Zedekiah's act of rebellion has catastrophic consequences for his country. For 18 months between 589 and 587 BC, Nebuchadnezzar's army besieges Jerusalem with the entire armed force of his vast empire, while Zedekiah refuses to capitulate. Siege works are erected, and finally, with nothing left to eat, Judah's own army breaches Jerusalem's walls from the inside and makes a midnight break for freedom. Zedekiah joins the Great Escape, and although the men manage to break through the ring fence of Babylonian soldiers, the king is separated from his guards. Isolated, Zedekiah is now easy prey for enemy troops, who capture him, then bring him 280 miles north to Nebuchadnezzar at his base in the city of Riblah. Zedekiah's sons have also been captured, and Judah's last king is forced to watch as they are executed, before he is blinded and led in chains to Babylon. A limestone quarry under the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem is called Zedekiah's Caves and is believed by some to be the place where the king was captured by the Babylonian invaders. Time has run out for Judah. With its king blinded and in chains, Babylonian troops set about destroying its capital city. Around a month after Zedekiah's capture, a Babylonian general named Nebuzaradan arrives at the gates of Jerusalem. Under his command, Solomon's fabulous temple is torched along with the royal palace and every building in the city. Jerusalem's defensive perimeter wall is broken down and anyone left in the city is dragged off into captivity. The entire population of Judah is then transported the 900 miles east to Babylon, leaving only a small group referred to as the poorest of the poor as caretakers of its ruins. Everything of any value that is left in the temple is stripped away, including the bronze from the two pillars that have stood since the time of Solomon and which measure 27 feet in height. While most of the exiles go on to live in relative comfort in Babylon, Nebuzaradan has other plans for its leaders. He transports Judah's high priest, the most senior temple priests under him, Zedekiah's military commander, and five of the king's advisers to Riblah, where Nebuchadnezzar has set up his temporary headquarters. With them are brought Zedekiah's officer in charge of conscripting soldiers, as well as the 60 troops who remained in Jerusalem at the time of its fall. Once they arrive in Riblah, the men are killed. It is without doubt the darkest day in the Old Testament. Despite the destruction of their nation being the work of Babylonian soldiers, the Israelites are coming face to face with what the Bible sees as divine retribution. The writer makes it clear that this is happening because God has had enough of his people's lack of faith and their failure to follow his laws. Jerusalem has fallen, and it is a terrible end to this once glorious city, the proud nation of Judah and its 460-year monarchy. With most of Judah's people now in captivity, Nebuchadnezzar appoints a new governor over the region. Gedaliah's exploits are described more fully in the book attributed to the prophet Jeremiah, who has the misfortune to live through the fall of Jerusalem. Here in the second book of Kings, readers are told that Gedaliah is appointed by Nebuchadnezzar to look after the sorry band of waifs and strays left in Judah. Gedaliah is the grandson of Shaphan, one of Josiah's senior officials, who we met in the previous episode. There still appear to be military commanders and soldiers in the country, and these men gather together at Judah's new administrative centre, Mizpah. This city was once favoured by the judge Samuel, and appears to survive as a holy place even after the Babylonian exile. Here, Gedaliah assures everyone that they have nothing to fear from Babylon, advising them that if they settle down quietly, they will thrive. As if things couldn't get any worse for the beleaguered nation that was once the envy of the known world, Gedaliah is murdered by a death squad led by a man named Ishmael. Ishmael has royal blood and no doubt believes that he is more entitled to rule than Gedaliah. It's more a massacre than an assassination, as Ishmael's men also kill all the leaders of Judah and Babylon who have gathered with Gedaliah in Mizpah. Fearing repercussions from Babylon, everyone who is able flees south to Egypt. The nation of Judah is no more. In an incongruous footnote, the story leaps forward 37 years to comment on the release of Judah's former king, Jehoiachin. There has been a regime change, and Awal-Marduk has now taken over as king of Babylon from his father, Nebuchadnezzar. The new king appears to be a fan of Jehoiachin, who he treats well, giving him a more prestigious seat at his table than his other captive kings, one of which might be Jehoiachin's blinded uncle, Zedekiah. Clearly a favourite of Awal-Marduk, Jehoiachin is given civilian clothes to wear and is even provided with an allowance. They may have been warned numerous times by their prophets that their godless behaviour can only have one outcome, but being evicted from the promised land is enormously traumatic for the Jewish people. The Bible sees Judah's punishment very much as an act of God. As payback for centuries of rebellion against God, its people are packed onto wagons and deported to central Iraq. It is a sudden and shocking wake-up call that God genuinely appears to have abandoned them and that the prophets who they roundly ignored were right. It's profoundly confronting for God's people. During the time which they are forced to spend in Babylon, the Jews are bedfellows with others whose belief system is entirely different to their own. They have no temple, no control over their lives, and their fabulous city has been destroyed. Fearful that the concept of God might be lost forever, some Jewish scribes write down the history of their people. It is now that historians believe that the story of the creation, the flood, the Exodus, and the journey to the Promised Land are inked onto parchment for the first time. Meanwhile, prophets like Ezekiel write dire warnings of what horrors might come down on the Jews if they don't turn back to God. They may be in Babylon against their will, but historians believe that the Jews are able to live in relative freedom, working and paying taxes to support the imperial economy. Some thrive, like Daniel and his co-workers, whose stories appear later in the Bible, where they attain high positions in the Babylonian civil service. But the exile is utterly dispiriting. The sense of loss is immeasurable, as is the fear that God has rejected his people. All the more reason for Israel's holy men to double down and encourage their people to get back on track, because, despite how it looks, all might not be lost. But rather than describe the Babylonian captivity or explain what happens next in the history of the Jewish people, the Bible's next book sings to its own tune. A different scribe retells the history of Israel's kings. But don't be thinking this is a simple cut-and-paste carbon copy of the Books of Kings. The two Books of Chronicles carve their own unique path in the Bible, and I absolutely love them. Season 12 is next. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with original music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. If you'd like to send any comments or feedback, you can do so. contact@holybible.com. And if you like what you're hearing, please do tell your family and friends. And if you're feeling super generous, leave us a nice star rating at whatever channel you're listening on. Thank you very much. See you next time.